Greetings, fellow constant readers. You are listening to, or maybe you're watching, The Company of the Mad, The Stand podcast. I'm your host, Jason Seacrest. On today's episode, my distinguished panel and I will be discussing chapters 25 through 42 of Stephen King's epic novel, The Stand. But we don't want to be the only ones talking about it. We want to hear from you. So if you're reading or rereading the novel right along with us, be sure to let us know. Drop us a line using the hashtag TheStandChallenge on Twitter. We would love to hear your thoughts. If you're listening to The Stand podcast on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, or other such audio-only platforms, hey man, that's pretty cool. But don't forget that you can also watch the video exclusively at TheStandPodcast.com. Then you can see all our smiling faces. TheStandPodcast.com, by the way, is also where you will get links to all of our Twitters, bonus podcast episodes, and a whole lot more. Mike Flanagan is with us. He is the writer and director of Dr. Sleep, Netflix's The Haunting of Hill House, and so much more. He's currently finishing up production on The Haunting of Bly Manor.
Hello.
Hello. Tananarive Due is a novelist and the producer of Shudder's Horror Noir, A History of Black Horror. She teaches Black Horror and Afrofuturism at UCLA, and you can take her online digital download course, The Sunken Place, by going to TananariveDue.com. Tananarive, hello.
Hi, everyone.
Anthony Bresnikan is a novelist and has worked as a reporter for the Arizona Republic, the Associated Press, USA Today, and Entertainment Weekly, just to name a few. He is currently the Los Angeles correspondent for Vanity Fair. Hello, Anthony.
Hey, I got to give Tananarive a shout out, though, before we get too far. Your Twilight Zone episode is out this week, right?
It's coming out next. Yes, it's coming out. Yes, it's out. When this comes out, it's out. Yes.
We're in the future, Tananarive.
We're in the future, so yes.
That's perfect.
And it's had an amazing response. Everyone loves it.
Which episode number is it?
It's number 8, and it's called A Small Town. And thank you so much for mentioning that, because since it's episode 8, I thought I would have to wait 8 weeks from the premiere date to see it. And the CBS was like, no, it's coming out in a binge. So thank you. I'm so excited.
They dropped the entire season at once, didn't they?
Yes.
Oh, that's amazing.
You can see the whole thing. You co-wrote it with your husband, Stephen, right?
I did. I'm so starry-eyed over the episode. I forgot to mention that. Thank you. Thank you for saving my marriage, Anthony. Definitely co-wrote. We also husband and wife writing pair. I co-wrote that episode with my husband, Stephen Barnes, who also wrote episodes for the 80s version of The Twilight Zone. So he's an old
fan. Awesome. No way.
So, yes.
That's awesome.
Wow. Yes.
That show is, the 80s Twilight Zone was great. They were really good episodes.
Yes.
Those scared the heck out of me when I was a kid.
Yeah. So it's a homecoming for him and my first scripted television episode for me.
Very
congratulations.
Cool. Congratulations.
Fantastic.
Yeah, that's insane.
Well done.
Incredible.
I cannot wait to watch.
We're also joined today by a very special guest. You may recognize her from such films as Oculus, Hush, and Gerald's Game, or you might know her as Theo Crane on The Haunting of Hill House. Kate Siegel is here with us, and she is a longtime constant reader. Welcome, Kate.
Yeah.
To the Company of the Mad.
Wow, thank you guys. It's such an honor to be here. Thanks for allowing me to step into the asylum for the day.
Absolutely. Now listen, on our first episode, I asked everybody the same question, and I'd like to pose it to you. How is it that you came to love Stephen King, and mm-hmm. when did you first read The Stand?
Wow. I have been a fan of Stephen King for so long that I'm not exactly sure the first time I read one of his books. I know that in the basement of my house, my dad had these floor-to-ceiling bookshelves with every single Stephen King book on them. And my dad was an investment lawyer. Like, he was a very serious guy, but this was like his collection of Stephen King books. And as a matter of fact, I'm sitting here with his copy of The Stand that has traveled with me across the country into every other place I have ever lived. And so I know that I was reading it really early, like probably inappropriately early, probably like somewhere between 8 and 10, I started with the short stories. And I have read The Stand at least once a year since then. I think this sounds ridiculous, and that's why I'm so thrilled to be here. I truly believe that in very short amount of time, this will become one of the great American novels. I think it addresses huge, important issues that are deeply American. Anything like in the same way that Steinbeck does, or, you know, any of our great American novelists, this is a really important book, and I think it's extremely important right now. And I think Stephen King is as close as I get to like hero worship in the way that he addresses female characters and the way that he addresses relationships between people and the way that he is able to scare me into insomnia.
And the way that he can be almost like a prophet. I mean, the fact that this is written in the 1970s and what we're looking at today is just, you know, over a month ago, we entered into this project of rereading The Stand, and Mike noted on the first episode how strange it is to be reading a novel in which the escapist hook is a global pandemic, and then you close the book and you look out the window at the global pandemic.
Yeah.
And as we enter into the next 200 pages of The Stand, it's what it really is heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking and startling and just completely surreal to see the times that we're living in mirrored once more. Chapter 26 begins with law enforcement officials using violence to stop people from taking or airing videos in which they are speaking the truth. The National Guard is brought in to prevent looting. There's a man on the street who's carrying a sign that's speaking his particular and personal truth, and he is descended upon, attacked, and beaten with it. In the book and in the world today, we have gone from pandemic to pandemonium. And there is such a heaviness that I felt reading this chapter and that I feel even speaking about it now. I'd like to get each of your thoughts on what it is that you felt as you started your read or your reread through these particular pages of The Stand. Tanana Reeve?
Yeah, I'll just jump in, and it is sad, as you say, Jason.
It really is.
There's an uplifting element to worldwide protests for Black Lives and Black Lives Matter and the growing awareness and the willingness of so many people to listen who really weren't paying attention to hashtags before the killing of George Floyd, before the killing of Breonna Taylor. I do feel hopefulness in that sense. So I want to start from a hopeful place. It's more than eerie how thin the veneer is over what so many of us have viewed as American society when someone goes outside to speak the truth or hold up a protest sign, et cetera, et cetera. There are lines from chapter 26 that really jump out at me. It's still a free country, right? one journalist says, or these men are acting like Nazis, not American soldiers. Those are kids. They're just kids. They're not armed. So there's what you see on the news, which is one version. You know, if there's a fire or if there's violence, you see that on the news. But on social media, there's a different version that often doesn't get addressed on the news, like protesters who lost eyes, journalists who were attacked.
It's not getting addressed on the news. It's insane. I when I talk to my mother, who doesn't have things like, you know, she has Facebook, but she doesn't have Twitter and Instagram and that sort of thing. I'm like, you wouldn't believe the videos that I've seen that I sent her, and she's like, why isn't this on the news? It's bizarre. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, it's so and that way it's a teachable moment, I think, for all of us who live in the country, some who were more aware than others. It happened during Ferguson that journalists were attacked by police. That's how Ferguson made national news, when journalists were attacked. And that lesson hasn't been learned, apparently. There are some very, very serious issues that have to be addressed in law enforcement. I was grateful, though, one way that reality departed in a good way was the military pushing back against being used to suppress protesters, which is hugely, hugely important. So again, that speaks to that hopefulness. Just when you feel like you're teetering at the edge of, oh my gosh, even I, with all my civicism and all my Black history lessons, don't recognize what's going on right now. There's that hope that we can not just write, you know, go back to where we were, but to be better than we were.
You did mention, I noticed on your Twitter account, I loved that there was this moment where you were discussing with someone else everything that's going on in the protesting, and you said, is it wrong for me to say this, or is it weird for me to say that this is one of the few times, or one of the first times, I think you said that you felt oddly hopeful, that there was a feeling of positivity surrounding.
I know what you mean. In the run up to the last election, a lot of people were like, "What is happening?" That was like the catchphrase. What is happening? What is it? And after a while, it got so repetitive that I retired it, because things were just getting worse and worse and worse and worse for so many populations in the United States. But then I found myself in the wake of protests and widening awareness, thinking, "What is happening? What is happening?" And it was like a cheerful "what is happening." And that's something I wasn't used to. And, you know, it'll ebb and flow. But right now I do feel that we are in a good place to do a better job than the characters in the stand.
Kate, what was that, Anthony?
We couldn't do a worse job. They pretty much blow it. That's true. Before the society collapses, and then, you know, arguably,
they do all right.
Kate, what was your feeling as you were coming to these particular pages?
Going through those pages, I think the thought that was going through my head over and over again was just, "There but for the grace of God go us." I think that it was interesting. It's written at a time before cell phones and before social media, and there's a certain sense that we are hit with a constant tidal wave of this 24-hour news cycle, and that it can be really detrimental to people's spirit in situations like these. But I think it also keeps us from a lot of this panic, because the pandemic requires us to stay home. And part of the reason we can stay home is that we can connect with each other through technology, right? And if we didn't have that, and part of what makes a protest so powerful right now is that people are risking their own health because the general health of society is at more danger than the individual's respiratory system. We have to go out there and stand up for the things we believe in now, and that's more important than the coronavirus for people. But in these pages, because these people can't get information from Twitter and they can't get information from the internet, the distribution requires them to go out into the world, and that kind of hits these more powerful protest moments where the army is shooting on kids, where people are taking over news stations. And I think we are saved in some way from that by social media. But it is, this escapist book is not escapist at all. It could very easily, we could just make a little left and we could be in this situation. If Trump did what he said and he silenced the media, some stations would fight back and you would have situations like this.
You're absolutely right. Anthony, how did you feel as you were coming to it?
I thought this was one of the scariest chapters in the book. I think the tunnel sequence is, you know, famously a creepy, eerie sequence in the stand. But the breakdown of society, when you see people dying, not just from the gooey Captain Tripp's illness, but turning on each other violently so. The Ray Flowers sequence always got to me. And I actually thought it was really well done in the original miniseries too. Kathy Bates, they gender swapped it, and Kathy Bates played Ray Flowers. And the idea of it, that you would be gunned down on the air, you know, that is somehow not as bad as the news getting out to the people who are holding those guns. Is a pretty terrifying prospect. It reminds me a little of, I think it was Allende in Chile, who was giving a radio broadcast when Pinochet's forces were taking over the country, and he was killed. I don't know if it was like on the air, but right after he made like a kind of defiant broadcast, and mm-hmm. you know that. That kind of thing is really chilling and disturbing. The way, you know, some of the soldiers are like, "Are we really going to do this?" Like, that also freaked me out. I think I kind of wonder if that's what happens in a mob mentality, when you have police officers in riot gear kind of psyching each other up and scared themselves maybe a little and ready to mm-hmm. and feeling threatened and psychologically threatened and criticized and ready to lash out. That anger could be explosive. All it takes. I've covered protests as a journalist, For years before I did entertainment, I was a general assignment reporter, and I would cover things like that. And sometimes they would go badly, and you could always see where it went bad, where somebody threw a punch or threw a bottle or a cop hit somebody with a club, and that's where the conflagration spread. And it's funny, I want to bring up something. Our host Jason tweeted about this. The next 200 pages in The Stand begin with law enforcement using violence to stop people from taking airing videos that speak the truth. The National Guard is brought in to prevent looting. A man on the street carrying a sign is attacked and beaten with it. And he got a reply. I don't know if I can, I guess I can't really see there. The reply itself is from Stephen King. It doesn't change, does it? That was pretty remarkable that he saw that.
It doesn't change.
I have a feeling that it's thanks to Mike that he saw it. I think Mike retweeted it right before Stephen King did. So it's probably thanks to our distinguished panelists, one of our distinguished panelists, Mike Flanagan. So
we got to get Uncle Steve on this podcast.
That would be incredible, man. That'd be great.
All of that said, there was one part of this sequence that really bothered me, and it was the black men in loincloths who take over, I guess, a game show set or something.
And yeah.
To me, that was like, every now and then, I love Steve, and I love his work. It means a lot to me. But every now and then, there's just a part of the book that I wish wasn't there, and this was, I have to say, this was one. I don't know what he was going for. I guess maybe some sort of a regressive thing that society's breaking down, and they're going, violent or tribal or something. I don't really get what was going on there, but I didn't really care for it. And
it's a pink leather loincloth, I think.
Yeah, where did you get that?
Second reading, I was like, oh, it's pink leather. I think there is something he's going for with it that is not like Tarzan loincloth kind of esque.
Yeah. But
I'm not sure. And I have to say, those kind of references do pop out at me and kind of throw me out of the story for a second, and then I come back in. But and I too have so much great admiration for Steve, as we'll call him, for the show. And I know as an artist myself, in fairness, that I have been to readings where I'm reading my own story that I wrote 20 years ago, and I come across a phrase that jumps out, like, not maybe loincloth, but not my best moment. You know, I wasn't thinking about a fuller readership. My thinking hadn't evolved, and even if it's in the character's head, I just feel weird, so I'll just skip right over that. You know, I will just like not read that word or that phrase, like keep it moving. And I have a feeling if he were doing that, he might do something similar with a reference like the loincloth.
Speaking of your writing and your reading, guess what I read at around noon today? I read a short story by Tanana Reeve-Dhu called Herd Immunity.
Oh, right.
And Herd Immunity my goodness, what a fantastic short story. I mean, you've really, in talking about, you know, the fact that Stephen King is almost prophetic in what he's doing and acting like a prophet, I mean, you've literally done the same thing here. I mean, it's you have pinpointed certain aspects of this pandemic. And like the people who are continuing to wear the masks, the wanting to stay a certain distance away from people, and the other people who are insistent that there's no need for that anymore. There's all kinds of the fact that this sort of germ originates in China. All of this is, it's very interesting. Like you're really quite the prophet yourself.
Homage to Stephen King, first of all, in writing about plague. Any plague story that comes to my mind is always going to go back to, you know, having read The Stand in childhood. But also that was for an anthology called The End Is Now, where it was supposed to be, what would the end of the world feel like? So even though she's not the last survivor, she meets this guy on the road. She thinks they're both immune. I won't give away the ending, but let's just say we shouldn't always make assumptions.
Man.
The part about the masks is eerie. So at the very, very beginning, or when the pandemic was on its way, I started tweeting that story back when we were all watching Contagion, and we were like, oh, you know, let's try to manage our fear by diving in. But then at a certain point, I couldn't watch any more plague movies or read any more plague stories. So I stopped tweeting that story. But now that there's this movement toward reopening, and I see so many people walking around without these masks, I've started tweeting it again. It's like, hello. this isn't over just because you want it to be over.
Yeah, total cautionary tale. Now it's really something. It's a beautiful and brilliantly written piece of work, though. Like, I mean, it was an absolute joy to be able to read it today. And anyone who was looking for it, you can actually find it online. If you just do a Google search for it, you can find it, I believe, and read it. It's really, really something.
It's free.
Yeah, it's free. Mike, how did you feel when you were reading chapter 26 in particular?
I think very similar to what everybody else has said, for sure. And I agree, its relevance to our current situation is uncanny and disturbing and weirdly, darkly cathartic. I felt also reading it, I completely agree with you, Anthony, this is some of the scariest stuff in the whole book. And, you know, the tunnel sequence, of course, and even, you know, Stu's escape, terrifying. And for me, there was a section of this that I either had completely forgotten about or just didn't land on me the first time I read the book before I had kids. But the entire second wave section about, you know,
the
other elimination.
Oh, it's the worst.
The story of the little Sam Tauber, the 5-year-old whose family dies and is left alone. And it's only a page, really, the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And that was like just a dagger to the heart for me. I just couldn't. It was one of the most horrifying and matter of fact and detached, but so realistic and likely stretches of the book. And it just, that whole section, which had another moment, I think, similar to the game show bit where I was like, I don't know about the woman who, the whole thing was about how she feared rape. And that was kind
like,
of
what a loser she is. For
yeah.
Being
it,
so
it,
scared
was a,
of
it was a very strange section. But ultimately, for as horrifying as it was, and how I still felt like there's that uncanny moment you have where you close this section of the book and you look outside and you still feel like it's a parallel story and it's way too close for comfort. The fascinating thing about this stretch for me is in the introduction of who I think is might so far be my favorite character of the book on this read, which is Glenn. I loved Glenn and I was trying to figure out why. And so the two things I wanted to do is I want to read a very brief section of something he says that really bowled me over, because I think there's a major tonal shift in the story the second he appears. And I was trying to figure out what that was about, like why the air changed when Glenn Beighton showed up. And so this paragraph just kind of knocked me down, and then I'll tell you why I think that is. But he's sitting there and he's fishing and he says to Stu, you know, I was prejudiced against the world. I admit that freely. The world in the last quarter of the 20th century had, for me at least, all the charm of an 80-year-old man dying of cancer of the colon. They say it's a malaise which has struck all Western peoples as the century, any century, draws to a close. We've always wrapped ourselves in mourning shrouds and gone around crying, woe to thee, O Jerusalem, or Cleveland, as the case may be. The dancing sickness took place during the latter part of the 15th century. Bubonic plague, the Black Death, decimated Europe near the end of the 14th. Whooping cough near the end of the 17th, and the first known outbreaks of influenza near the end of the 19th. We've become so used to the idea of the flu. It seems almost like the common cold to us, doesn't it? That no one but the historian seems to know that 100 years ago it didn't exist. And that to me, I thought was, I mean, other than being, again, profoundly relevant to where we are right now, what struck me about the difference between this character and the others is that Glenn is talking with authority and with knowledge about the past, the present, and for the first time in the novel, the future. And I thought that was incredibly striking, that, you know, we have all these characters who are caught in this immediate sense of the present, who are kind of uniformly terrified of the present throughout it, and then talk about the past. You know, Larry talks about his mother and Franny remembers, you know, growing up, and everybody kind of looks backward and looks at where they are and they're paralyzed. And then all of a sudden this character comes in who's looking ahead, and his whole thing to Stu is about, what is society going to be like after this? Are babies going to be immune? What will civilization do to pick itself up? What will that look like? No other character in the book to this point has had forward facing vision. And Glenn is looking at it academically, but with this very wry and gentle wit to him that I think comes with the fact that he's not going to live much longer anyway. You know, that Glenn had already kind of come to the point in his life where he feels like he's lived a full one and is now witness to this. And it's such a different voice, and it's such a different air, that all of a sudden that suffocating feeling that I'd had reading, and a wonderful suffocating feeling, you know, reading up to this point, the horrors of Captain Trips and the horrors of the breakdown of civilization and the horrors of these people dying anonymous deaths alone, all of that I got to kind of exhale for a second and say, yeah, okay, so what now? What are the steps forward from this point? And I was momentarily jealous of the book for that. It was a very strange sensation of just kind of being like, oh God, to feel, what will it feel like when we feel like this particular wave that we're caught in has crested and receded, you know? And I'm sure that's not going to be easy for any of us, but just that sense of what that could feel like, just, I think, kicked in a new instrument in this story. And that was what I came away with the most on this
panel. He's such a wonderful character. It almost feels, you're right, it's such a different character from anyone who we've encountered so far. And it almost feels like another part of Stephen King's mind. Like it's so genuine, and it's so genuinely written, and it's sort of like the academic part of his mind. And it does sort of make me wonder suddenly if all of these characters are just different personalities who live inside of him.
I do think that there is, there's a very interesting parallel in the forward-looking characters in the way that Glenn looks forward, but you forget that also Franny is someone who is obsessed about the future because she's pregnant. And so we do have this, in this section, one of my favorite parts of this book is Franny burying her father. And pregnant Franny having to look down at the corpse of her dad and make the emotional choice to wash him. And at first, remember, she doesn't make that choice. She's like, I can't do it. I can't possibly. And then as she thinks about the future, and she is locked, she's lost in her own thought downstairs, and she almost sets the house on fire cooking potatoes, she realizes that the person she wants to be is the person who washes and dresses her father and buries him in the garden. And she starts to come to terms with herself and her mother and her dad in that moment, something that Larry never does, something that Harold never does. Steve, as we call him in this podcast, he gives his women this opportunity to grow and change. I love his women in this book, and we forget that this was written at a time where people would expect that kind of self-awareness from your male lead, from your Larry Underwood, and he doesn't get there until way later. But Franny and Dana and Sue and Nadine, they're already looking forward. There's this political theory that the only people who should be able to be president are women with young children, because they're the only people who are actually living in the future. And I think that Franny is a great example of that. It's a great balance to Glenn, because like you said, Glenn has a sociological kind of distance from this because he's not going to live 50 years either way. Whereas Franny is desperate to know about the future and to build the future. And the second in this section, she and Harold stumble on Stu, she's like, yes, we need more people. We need to gather together. And she is kind of the opposite balancing force to that future movement.
Anthony, were you wanting to break in there and say something?
I was going to say something. I was trying to look it up, not to like name drop or anything, but when I interviewed King about a month ago, our first look at the new Stan miniseries, he explicitly said Glenn Bateman is the character he created to add his own voice to the story. Like, he was like, Glenn is me stepping in to talk about my views on what we mean as a society, what we are going forward. And it's funny because when Mike was reading that section, I was like, this sounds like it could almost be from like an introduction to the book, right? Like where he's talking about the flu and how we perceive the flu or how we're afraid of things or cease to be afraid of them. And yeah, he flat out said, my ideas about what makes a society are all expressed through Glenn. So the fact that he has a different tone to him, he's almost like the narrator stepping in, but becoming part of the cast, like part of the story. And so you guys were right on whatever you picked up. I didn't know that until he told me, but there it is. He is, he puts on the hat and the picks up the paintbrush and he's Glenn.
Well, there is this, I mean, Mike, do you want to read it? There's this fantastic other quote from Glenn. You read the last one so well. There's this great quote from Glenn on what creates a society.
Oh, can I do it?
You can, absolutely, yes. I mean,
thought Mike was going to read my quote.
No, I mean, it really is, it's sort of like, it expresses what the entire book is about in many ways. So please, absolutely, read it.
Well, of course, now it won't be the same one you're thinking of at all. But
It might not be, but I think it is. I think
show me a man or woman alone.
Yes,
you got it. I'll show you a saint. Give me two, they'll fall in love. Give me three, they'll invent the charming thing we call society. Give me four, and they'll build a pyramid. Give me five, and they'll make one an outcast. Give me six, and they'll reinvent prejudice. Give me seven, and in 7 years, they'll reinvent warfare. Man may be made in the image of God, but human society is made in his opposite number. And that is definitely the passage that made me think, that's King. Yeah. Yeah, I'm so glad you confirmed that. Yeah, because I thought that that might be the case. But I do find it an interesting contrast between Glenn and Franny. Because Glenn is that older character, more of a philosopher. He reminds me a lot of my dad, who's 85, civil rights lawyer. And when various things happen in the news that have me completely upset, he still has his sense of humor typically, and he's focused on the philosophical questions, right? He lives in his head in that way. And I'm more like, I'm a mom, I've got a 16-year-old son, what in the world, you know, am I going to have to be terrified that he's going to be pulled over or whatever? So there is an interesting difference in approaching these kinds of traumas and questions according to whether you're in my dad's place where he's lived a very long life and he's seen a lot of change and ups and downs and things get bad and things get better. And Franny, who I can't even imagine. Frankly, I can't imagine, honestly, I feel so badly for anyone who's pregnant now in actual life. Who's and it's getting a little bit better. I understand maternity wards have some different vibes where you don't feel like necessarily you're taking your life in your hands. But yeah, to bring a new life into this world at a time when there is so much uncertainty and growing uncertainty would be really, really daunting. So that does make Franny a really interesting character. But Glenn, yeah, when he speaks, it's like he wanted to stop everything.
Well, Glenn almost speaks for Franny in one section where, I mean, I think that maybe
I don't think Franny would allow that.
No, I mean, you're probably right. But like, I mean, I think it's just, maybe I'm a complete idiot. I very possibly am. But like, I remember the first time that I read the novel feeling like when we get to Glenn talking about whether or not babies will be immune to this or whether they won't be, it's like for the first time it dawns on me, wait a minute, Franny's got a baby. Like, what's gonna happen with her baby? Like, I remember just being like, I hadn't even thought, because Franny hasn't talked about it. Franny hasn't actually like uttered any words about that yet, about questioning what will happen to her child.
Is she writing in her journal yet at this point?
Not yet. No.
She hasn't started the book.
No, but I mean,
think that's interesting. And I don't mean to interrupt. I'm a terrible interrupter. And if I'm, all right. No, but I think that has something to do with when she falls in love. I think that Franny is in what I hope to bring to like this understanding. I don't have a deep understanding of King or story structure or writing novels like that. But what I do have is a love of character. And what I do see in Franny is that she didn't love Jess, the father of this child. The man she loved, her father, she had to bury. There was a lot of trauma in pushing that down. she doesn't really deal with the baby when she's carrying her very heavy father down the stairs. She's not worried. We don't have a lot of her worry about losing the child at that moment. And then when she and Stu meet, and then he says later in the book, it takes them about 4 hours to fall in love. After that moment, she starts to worry about the child verbally. She starts writing it down in the book, in the diary, which, you know, becomes downfall later, but that's okay. But I think that the falling in love is something that changes her. And Franny, the combination of Franny and Glenn sits with me in the same way that, like, I desperately want to have dinner with Tabitha King, because there's got to be someone in King's life that is like this. This woman who becomes passionate, and she's feminist at a time before you were allowed to be a feminist character. And she starts to write down and keep record in the same way Glenn does. I think I made that leap just in the middle of my thought process, but she is such the emotional kind of heartbeat of this group. Even later on when they become the ad hoc committee, she ends up taking care of everybody and kind of speaking as the conscience, as Glenn goes on to be the mind, the heart and the mind.
Wow. I mean, you couldn't have said it better. I mean, I talked a lot about Franny in the last episode, in saying, I do feel personally more connected to her chapters. I don't know why, than anyone else's. Like, they suck me in for some reason, where it's that weird thing that only happens really, I think, when you're reading a book, where you just get completely lost in the story. You're not thinking about time or space or anything. And I think we all have characters that we do that with. But for me, it's, and that's the great thing about this thing, is there's so many characters, you can choose any of them. For me personally, it's every time Franny, I just keep waiting for another Franny chapter. I'm just like, as I'm turning, I'm like I love them all. I'm not going to say anything about any of them, but there are certain chapters that I'm like, all right, Lloyd, get through it. Like,
King loves Franny. He loves her. It feels like he loves her.
Yeah, absolutely.
To me, like, Mike, you're a writer. When you write for me, I can feel that you love me. I feel that, like, you love me. I feel it when I read it, because, you know.
He puts you in terrible situations. What do you mean?
Yeah, but he writes with such love. Like, think about Theo Crane. Think about, like, the depth of understanding of humanity Mike gave her, because Mike at that time was writing for someone he truly loved. And I feel that when I read Franny. I feel King loving her.
Wait a minute, do you two know each other?
Oh God, that's so awkward. Sorry, no, I'm a stalker of Mike's, so weird.
Ladies and gentlemen, Kate and Mike are married, in case you did not know.
Right.
In case you're just tuning in for the first time to that information.
So sorry.
No, it's fine.
Everybody knew
that. No, I love it. And it's great. It's probably true. Mike, is that true?
But they're quarantining from each other, as you see.
They are. They're in completely separate houses. They're not. That's great. Mike, do you feel that way about character and about writing when you're really passionate about a character? Do you find that it comes across more on the page?
Oh, certainly. And you know, I think King is such an empathetic writer in general with his character. I think he's in love with a lot of the characters on this page. I even feel love for Lloyd, you know, in that beautiful scene where Flag finally comes into the prison.
Oh, yes.
True. You know, but I think the point is absolutely correct. I think, you know, I do think he writes a lot about Tabitha as well. I think so she appears in a number of different incarnations throughout his library of work. And I wouldn't at all be surprised if he were to say, yes, if you look at Franny, that's where I saw the most of Tabitha. That wouldn't shock me. I don't know that, but that would be a good guess based on the way he does that. I think another character that I think we should spend some time on too, is he introduces another major, incredible woman to the story, in that we finally really get a look at Mother Abigail in this section.
We get just a first glimpse at her.
Yeah. What a
glimpse it is, man. Like, so great. And just really, that's another character that for sure completely sucks me in anytime. That I'm reading the book. I mean, and it's a wonderful, wonderful sort of introduction to everything that is to come with her.
Does anyone see anyone other than Ruby Dee when they read Mother Abigail? Like, I just pure Ruby Dee.
Yeah, it's hard not to. It's hard not to at this point.
I know she's Whoopi Goldberg in the new miniseries, right? And I'm sure Whoopi will do great, but until I see that, it's definitely Ruby Dee in my memory.
You know, Whoopi said she wanted the part back in the day, 20 years ago when they first
saw.
I'm excited to see her Mother Abigail.
What, said she wanted to do it, but couldn't, you know, make it happen, or was approached by it, and not that she always loved the character. And you know, we'll see what she does. Hey, it's always nice to see it.
Oh, of course.
Ruby Dee was great. Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis was also in The Stand.
Right. You know,
I don't think they had any scenes together, come to think of it, but that's nice showcase for the two of them.
Yeah.
It's I think going to be very interesting. It strikes me how much I picture the cast of McGarris's adaptation when I read this.
Me too.
And how I had to make that little adjustment with Rita, where I was like, oh right, it was always just Nadine in the miniseries, but of course, no, this is a different character.
I went through the same thing.
Yeah, it's that thing of like, and here's, you know, I see Laura San Giacomo, and it was like, oh no, not yet. She's not here yet.
But
it's funny. I think of Glenn, and it's like all I see is Ray. Ray. Oh God, I'm blanking.
Ray Walston.
My favorite Martian. Ray. Yes. Ray Walston. Yes. And I believe it's Greg Kinnear playing him in the new one. And I love Greg Kinnear. And so I'm fascinated to see how he'll be able to kind of push Ray out of my mind.
Although I love the casting of Rita. We were talking about that.
That's Heather Graham, right?
Yeah, that it's there's this weird thing that happens when you read The Stand and you read it as a teenager and these people all seem so old, and then you read it again in your 20s and you're like, oh right, totally. And now in my late 30s reading it again and being like, oh, I'm way too old for all of this. Like, these are all people in their young 20s.
Everyone's younger than you.
Everyone's younger. And then you get to Rita, and then she's like, the first time you read it, this kind of decrepit old woman approaching 50, and I'm like, whoa. Then I'm on IMDb and I'm like, oh no, that's literally Heather Graham's actual age. Yeah. And I, oh,
really?
Too much. Heather Graham. It's on the internet, so I don't know if it's true
Heather
or not.
Graham is almost, I mean, I'm getting there too. So
according to IMDb, she turns 50 this year.
Wow.
So she's Heather the perfect Graham? I know, that's like the Stand, the great American novel.
Hey, Bill and Ted are now middle-aged, so
we're so old.
Yeah, since you all brought Rita up, I just thought I have to say, you know, and she's fine, I feel bad for her. Obviously she was traumatized and all that, but I don't know, I keep thinking about that movie The Mountain Between Us, where you're in the disaster but you're with Idris Elba. And Rita didn't put on comfortable shoes.
She's just walking white privilege. That's what she is.
Flee a dead city on foot. She knew. I'm thinking, well, did he not tell her they were on foot? I mean, what? I don't know. It's the trauma. But since, as I said in the last podcast, I am very partial to Larry, as flawed a character as he is, or perhaps because he's so flawed, I really found myself empathizing with his situation. I mean, of course, it's horrible that Rita died. It's horrible. And the way she died is also very horrible. But his sense of relief, I could forgive him for, is all I'm saying. He didn't even want to entertain it. He feels bad. No, he's no nice guy, all that. But I think on one level, he was also being hard on himself, because it would be tough to survive long term.
You have a thing like for Rita Larry. Larry. You've got a thing for
I do.
Larry. I like, and you know, the casting for Larry in the new miniseries is really good. It's Jovan Adepo, who was in that J.J. Abrams produced World War II movie about the Nazi zombies.
Oh, yeah. That was good.
Overlord.
It's an honor. Yeah. I thought of Larry when I read your story today, and with the guitar slung on the dude's back, because he was,
you know, maybe that was unconscious homage as well, because again, you know, it went deep, that whole idea, man, you're just breaking in and this happens. I know it's petty. It's petty, but that's kind of where I was. I was in love with Larry even before I knew they were casting him Black there, Anthony. So I don't know. There's something about that character. But that dynamic with Rita, I mean, I really was proud of him on one level, that he took it upon himself to try to be her caretaker. I mean, although he wasn't really a caretaker. They were having sex. They're in a kind of a relationship, but a very uneven relationship in terms of the distribution of common sense, and not to be mean about it, but just he was less traumatized, or he was traumatized differently than she was. So she was more of a dependent, and that's tough. You know, it's almost like she was in a childlike state. Mm-hmm. And if it's a kid, sure, of course I'll take care of you. But when it's another adult, an adult who's older than you, in fact, that was a lot that he took on. He didn't handle it great, but he was doing his best. And yeah, he felt a little bit of relief. And I think a lot of the readers kind of could understand that.
I think that's true. I think King does a great job of introducing us to all different types of people, like not just the good or bad people survive the plague. It's just sometimes it's like the random Upper East Side woman who's addicted to pills and what that would be like.
Right.
You know, but I agree with you. I think Larry shows the patience of a saint in that section.
He did.
Remember that show Life After People? Like, it was like a TV series, and they would like explore like what would happen to our bridges and our skyscrapers.
Oh, right. Yes.
People just vanished. And in one of the early episodes, they talked about like, well, what would happen to pets, right? Like if you had a dog or a cat or a bird, like if that animal was trapped inside, they would starve to death. But what if they got out in the world and there was like they were like, you know, certain animals which we've bred to be you know, tinier or more fragile for like aesthetic purposes wouldn't survive, but other animals would. And I think of her as Rita as like a really like she poodle, like sleeps on like a purple sequined pillow and like has eats like people food or something. Like
she's not bred for survival.
She's so privileged. She's lived in this cloud, in this privileged, rich life where you can tell that she's never opened a can of food herself, let alone like cooked anything for herself. Just ill-equipped for survival. And of course then she doesn't. But like to me, she was just the example of like the person who, even though she's immune to the disease, like she's not immune from this sort of hard scrabble existence that faces everyone now. And that was, I think, a brilliant piece of storytelling, because she comes in and then she goes pretty quickly, but it's kind of like, just because you survived Captain Trips doesn't mean that you're going to survive the cruel, cruel world out there, you know?
It doesn't mean you're a survivor, which
Wow, that's very profound. It's very true.
Do you guys think you would survive? Each of you, do you think you would be a survivor?
What a great question.
Do you mean immune or capable of surviving?
Let's assume we're all immune. Let's assume that we were point of the 1% immunity. Okay. And everyone you love is dead. So Mike, we're like in alternate universe, but like we don't have each other. We're not partnered up.
That's a really good question. I think part of the reason I love horror and write horror is to try to answer that question for myself. Because I guess in my head, I am kind of a Rita. You know, I grew up with a fairly comfortable childhood and had both of my parents in my life. And there were a lot of struggles that I never encountered that are true of so many people I know. So I like to think I would be a survivor, but to what degree am I deluded? That's something I would find out very quickly. I will say two things are very important. The willingness to defend yourself is super, super important. To pick up a weapon like that, you know, that thing that drives us crazy in horror movies when they're like, but they're not great. Like grab something and hit the dude, you know, and I hope I'm that person at least, but I don't know about the rest.
I don't know. That's a really good question, Kate. Like, I think if everyone I knew was gone and I'm not sure I would want to keep going, you know? I think I'd be one of those characters from the chapter of like the others who go, mm-hmm. who just, I don't know. I'm not saying I would off myself, but I don't know that I would have the will to keep going if I lost everyone that I knew. And yeah. I think if I felt like I had someone else that I was on the journey with that I could help or protect or who would be company for me and had some reason to keep going, I would. But I think, I have to say, I don't know that I would be a survivor, because I don't know that I'd have the will for it. It would be maybe too overwhelming, yeah, if we're being honest.
That's a beautiful answer. Wow, I feel so selfish now.
Tanara Reeve, I think you would totally survive. You learned toughness from your mom and dad, and I think you. I would want to, if I had to survive, I would want to be with Tanara Reeve and her group, her crew.
It would be great. All of us as a group, we would rule.
Well, yeah. You got real Nadine issues though. Like, I'm a true Nadine. I got problems, so you don't want to be in my group. I'm easily seduced by power, so it's like real issues.
Mike, would you make it?
No way. I'd love to say yes, but I've seen me when like Postmates shuts down for a night. I've watched myself try to make a really good meal. And I feel like I'd want to say, like, yes, this is where I'd find out that I'm Larry. But this is where I find out I'm the guy who Larry passes, who's, like, heading to Yankee Stadium for, like, the worst possible reason. And like, you know, I'm just afraid that that's the reality of me. And that's how they'll find me. Or I'll be locked in the... I'll be locked in the freezer, you know, that I've been in and out of for 2 years and never realized there wasn't
there's not a latch on this thing.
Yeah. Oh, you know, it's like, I'd love to feel like I'm Stu Redman, but I feel like I'm a punchline at the end of the paragraph in this story. So yeah.
I remember when I was in high school, I gave the stand to my girlfriend, and she read it and she was like, you know who you remind me of? The guy who's with Franny at the beginning.
Oh no! Jess, he's the worst.
The one she doesn't really care about. Like,
yeah.
It didn't last.
Thanks.
What can I say?
Oh man!
Yeah. Like, wow. I no, can't.
That is a diss.
Stone cold.
What about you, Jason? Are you gonna live? Are you going to Vegas?
I'm always going to Vegas. I don't think that any of you are giving yourselves enough credit. I think that one of the great things about writing, and I tell you, if any of us are going to survive, it's Kate, because it's also about writing is in a form acting, but it's not really quite the same thing. And I think that an actor, especially an actor as great as Kate, I think that you do have a lot of different personalities living in your head. And I think that something would happen where we would suddenly sort of picture the form that we need to step into in order to survive this. Like, it's not a time to be me. It's a time to be this part of me that's compartmentalized that I'm now going to blow up to 100%, or I'm going to emulate I'm going to pretend to be Clint Eastwood in my head, or I'm going to pretend to be, acting is pretending and writing is pretending. And I think that if we can pretend hard enough that we can survive just about anything. That's a terrible answer, probably.
But no, I thought that was beautiful.
That was incredible.
That's a beautiful answer.
Do you charge by the hour? I feel like this is therapy now. This is great.
No, it is. It's true. I mean, sometimes you just got to fake it till you make it. And that's all acting is, really. So I think that we would survive. And, you know, I think, speaking of Larry and Rita and survival in general, we kind of glossed over it earlier, but I want to make sure that we don't, because everyone was sort of saying, you know, of course there's the tunnel scene. Like, of course there's the tunnel. But it's like, it's a big scene. Like, it's
incredible.
It's a great scene. And I think for me, this is only my second time reading. I know a lot of people, we've gotten tons of comments from listeners, by the way, who say that they read this book once a year, or they read it once every other year or something. And I think that it's this number one scene that I remembered the most reading the first time around. And I wondered why that was when I revisited this time. And I thought, well, in a very strange way, and maybe you guys can help me figure this out, I felt like it's almost a microcosm of what's going on in the story with everyone and what the story is about. And, you know, I kept coming back to Stephen King's It where in it, it's bridges. There's bridges everywhere. There's the trip-trapping of the Billy Groat's gruff nursery rhyme. Who's that trip-trapping on my bridge? There's the bridge that Adrian Mellon gets thrown off of. There's the bridge that connects the children's library to the adults' library in Derry. And it is really about the bridge that we walk from childhood to adulthood and the monsters that we have to face along the way. So now here we are in the stand with this tunnel. And I'm just thinking, it's amazing, it's a journey, and the stand is a journey. And they keep talking about journey. They use that word. There's so much talk about Tolkien before they even enter the tunnel, before they put their first foot in, they're calling it a journey. And what is it that they say? They call it, she says something about,
Yeah, Rita says it. She's going on an adventure for the first time since she was a child.
Yeah, she says the beginning of a journey, the way leads ever on. And it's sort of like, you know, the tunnel is, he's now inside, now that he's in the darkness, he's in the literal representation of everything that everyone else is in, which is the unknown. Like,
but I think
the total darkness and just sort of wondering, how am I going to get out of this? How am I going to get to the other end of it? Am I going to even survive it? And on top of it, what do we do as humanity in that moment, in those spaces? What does he do? He just randomly starts to open fire because his imagination has gotten the worst of him. And there's something there that makes me think the tunnel scene is the stand. The tunnel scene, and I haven't quite wrapped my head completely around it, but there's something there about having to go into the darkness in order to get to the light on the other end of the tunnel.
That's what I was going to bring up, and it hadn't occurred to me until you said it, was that language is all over all of the science, all of the political conversation about the pandemic that we're in. I mean, how often a week do we hear someone saying, we can see a light at the end of the tunnel, or in any political movement, you know, when they say, oh, there is a light at the end of this tunnel, or not yet, but there will be, you know, the immersive darkness with some kind of redemptive light at the end of it has become this vernacular. It's become part of the language of how we talk about going through a hardship. Especially one that takes time. So I think that's amazing what you said, that is the stand, that is the journey of it. Because it's, if you look at it that way, that's the journey that, you know, kind of any harrowing experience that brings about great change has to go through. I think maybe that's why we adopt that vocabulary so easily, kind of so instinctively.
But I think it is, definitely correct that the stand exists in a small microcosm in the tunnel, but I think it's not the tunnel, but you keep saying it when you talk about it, it's light and dark.
Yeah.
So if it is bridges, the stand is lightness and darkness. There's later on, it's about people turning the lights on in one city, and Vegas has the light and then they don't. And Flag is the darkness, the black, and Mother Abigail is the white. And Larry has his tiny light, his lighter in the tunnel, and he loses his light and he tries to bring light to the darkness. And like Mike was saying, it is this metaphorical language that we all use to talk about trauma, darkness and light. And that's what we really all have in that tunnel, is those moments in our lives where we are in pitch black, whatever that means to us emotionally. And we can't see the light. And I think that's like the root of fear for everyone. It's a different tunnel for everybody, but we all have one.
Yeah, there are times that, and that's great, that time, life just turns mean on you, you know, and it feels sort of like this betrayal of everything you knew or expected. I mean, you'd read stories about, of course, older people die, but when it happens to you, there's this personal journey and no one is in there with you, you know, except maybe whatever your faith is. And for a lot of people, that gets real shaky when they're in the middle of that tunnel too. And I agree. That's actually a great observation, Jason, that is the stand, you know. Who are you? Who are you when you drop that lighter? Are you that person who can keep moving forward, and maybe your hand is going to be on some dead body, or some soldier is going to blow your head off, or who knows what? And you die anonymous and alone, and you would have been better off, you know, on the other, at the beginning of the tunnel. So yeah, and that's also one of the scenes that stands out the most to me from the miniseries, because I know they didn't have a huge budget, or I'm assuming they didn't. I don't really know for a fact, but I assumed they didn't have a huge, huge budget. And I thought that scene was done really well, because just visually, it's so easy to understand how this would be a horrifying experience to have.
Absolutely. Anthony, how did you feel reading the Lincoln Tunnel scene the first time that you read it? And was there anything new that you were able to pull from it from this time?
I mean, I think it still just holds up as one of his best sequences ever. I mean, I think he's saying something for a guy with a career as rich and varied as his. But I thought, it still... I'm trying to remember what I experienced when I read it for the first time, which was so long ago. But I hadn't read a lot about Stephen King, right? Like I hadn't read much of like criticism or books about him. I was just reading the books themselves, so I hadn't heard like, oh, you know, there was no, I didn't know other Stephen King fans. There was nobody to say, wait till you get to the. This tunnel sequence. So I think I just kind of blazed into it and right through it. But I do remember like being really freaked by it. Like that sticks with you for a reason. And it's being in the dark. It's being in the basement when the light is off. It's being anywhere where there actually is nothing in the tunnel that can hurt them, right? They're dead bodies, but they're entombed in their cars. It's just, you see it. And the idea of them maybe not being dead is the freaky part, and the unknown. It's a plunge into the subconscious, and that's what I felt reading it now. I think before it was more like an adventure, like get through, go, 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 like faster, 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 get out of here. Like you sprint up the basement steps to get out of there when you get those weird chills. But this time I thought, oh yeah, there really is like a psychological layer to this. This is about, as you say, going through, getting through the light and the dark. Going through trauma to get toward the other side. It's daunting. Really great piece of writing, though.
And maybe it also ties into sort of this fear of loss of eyesight, you know, because in, like, when, I don't remember if Nick has lost his eye yet in these pages, but
I think he gets attacked later.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, but there is something about...
But he already can't hear, he can't speak. He's already at super, super risk for survivability. If he'd lost both eyes, forget about it, you know? And just how basic and necessary that eyesight is, and how frightening it would be to lose it. I had an eye doctor when I was a kid. I'm a little nearsighted, as you can see. And an eye doctor told my mom, well, you know, if you don't make her wear hard contact lenses, she's going to be blind by the time she's an adult. And that was not true. And hard contact lenses are the worst when you're 8 years old, believe me.
Yeah.
But because of that experience, I have had sort of this lifelong fear of loss of eyesight. So I know that had a strong impact on me personally. I often walk around with my eyes closed, almost as in practice, to not be afraid of the dark, to not be afraid of losing my sight.
We can't, go ahead, Mike.
Oh, last thing on the tunnel that just kind of occurred to me. It's also an incredibly cinematic sequence. When you're talking about eyesight, it just made me think about, yes, the actual behavior of the light in that, you know, we understand so clearly how the lighter works, and when he talks about how it gets hot and he has to stop and turn it off and you're in and out of light, there's something else that's kind of wonderful about it too, in that there's a lot of visual storytelling happening that's all after the fact. You know, he's seeing the evidence of people being gunned down. He surmises that there must have been a barricade and an automatic weapon, you know, kind of a turret turned in on the tunnel. And then when he does make it out to the other side, there's that very visual observation of how the traffic is backed up on the other side of the tunnel as well. And what that means to him when he says to Rita, no, because she says maybe it was only in New York. And he says, no, the just seeing, you know, the remains of all the other cars there tells him that that isn't the case. And there's something kind of magnificently cinematic about that, in the, you know, huge battle. This is a battle scene you're talking about that took place in the tunnel. That's only implied, you know, it's all ghosts now, even to us as readers. We're not privy to that in the present. We're just wandering through the aftermath of it, very much like these characters. And I think that's very impactful in a book where he's already using a lot of really cinematic technique. There's a, earlier on, I had flagged an edit that he did between two chapters where he cut out on Larry making a strawberry pie and then came into the next chapter on Franny seeing a strawberry pie in the fridge. And you can almost see the edit. It just goes right off the close-ups to hand it off. You know, there's truly a very visual, you know, pulse running through all of this. It's written like a movie in a lot of ways. And I think the sequence, you know, so far anyway, is for me the most cinematic, the most visual one that we've had. I think that's one of the reasons it burrowed in for me.
It's a great, great thing that you brought up about the strawberry pie. I had noticed that, but I hadn't thought about it in terms of cinema. And now that you mention it, you know, I was talking with Steve, we'll call him Steve. I was talking with Steve's first editor who edited The Stand at Doubleday. He edited all of his books, Bill Thompson. And Bill Thompson said, you know, the thing about Stephen King is that he writes with a camera in his head. And he said, I've told him that for years. Like that's really something about him. Like he just writes that way. And because of that, he's, you know, been able to make a lot of novels that were perfectly adapted to, well, if anyone knows, it's Mike. I mean, it's there's really a great substance there that is cinematic. And I hadn't even thought about that, how obviously if you were going to be making that into a movie that you would see the strawberry pie go from one to the other. We'll see if Josh does it. We'll see if he's keen to your thought process there. I love it. We've got one more new character that we were introduced to in these 200 pages that we haven't mentioned yet. We have to mention him. Kate?
The Trash Can Man.
Yes. you were too excited. I could see the expression on your face. So you go first. Trash Can.
No, this is not going to go the way you think it is, because I don't get Trash Can Man at all.
Really? Really? Okay. Got it.
Like, I know that everyone's like, trash is the best, and that's the whole thing about the uncut version is you get all this backstory and a lot more Trash Can Man. Even this time, I was like, why? What? Colin Robinson.
You know what? I can't say that much about it either, because there is only a small, there's only one chapter really where we see a lot of him. And I have heard too that there's way more of his story in the uncut version. This is my first time reading the uncut version. The only time I've read it was the 1970s version that was
right.
So I this will be interesting for me. It was an interesting chapter. I enjoyed it.
I'm excited to hear your take on that, because he is a beloved character.
Really?
To the point that like a lot of people point to him as one of his favorites. His casting was kept a secret for the new version.
Really?
And I think it's leaked a bit, but it's supposed to be a secret. Everyone loves Trash Can Man. I've never clicked in. Anyone else love Trash Can? Can someone help me out here? Mike!
Of course.
I love him, yeah.
Well, it was a good marriage while it lasted.
that was that. Yeah,
I love him.
I love him because he's one of the few characters that's utterly unaware of and unconcerned with the events of what's actually happening in the world. Yeah. And I think I can draw a connection between that character and so many people, even unfortunately in this kind of world mess that we're in right now.
Mm-hmm.
There's a purity to him as a character, where this is just an agent of kind of human impulse at its most destructive. And it's presented as childish. He lacks a cunning, evil intent that you get out of Randall Flagg. You know, this is a damaged person who causes damage and just lives to perpetuate it. And
it
never
like
seen
Tom.
Yeah, it's an interesting echo to Tom. Yeah, and he never seems to be completely cognizant of what he's doing or why. And there were just moments in this backstory. I mean, there are little things that I really appreciated, which I noticed a lot on this read, these tiny echoes to other King books. But there, in his flashbacks, you know, the other kids with Trash Can Man, they say "eek, a freak" whenever he's around, which is the same words that Abra Stone in Dr. Sleep says she experiences in people's heads. I expect if you were to dig, that's probably not the only time he uses that. It would be my guess, but
wow.
Specifically the child hearing wow. "eek, a freak," I've seen now in two novels, and I only caught it because I've you know had to deep dive Dr. Sleep so much. But
man, that's a good one, Mike. I haven't heard that.
I wonder if that's something he was called when he was a kid. You know,
I wonder. That's a great point. That would make sense. I think that is probably likely. And the that's an interest. If that's true, then I would say looking at this character as like if Glenn Bateman is King's intellect, voice, and heart kind of embodied, then Trash Can Man would be his trauma and his violence, that same side of him that creates Richard Bachman, you know, that who just wants to burn it down and see what sound it makes.
The graveyard shift writer as opposed to the Shawshank Redemption writer. Right about people. And like, he goes there. And I think that, you know, the chapter we began with where the world falls apart and people are shooting each other and the pink loincloth guy and all that, like these are all of his impulses of like, let's set the world on fire as a writer.
And talk about the ultimate outsider. I'm sorry, I hope I didn't cut you off. Talk about the ultimate outsider too. You know, he meets his moment at last sort of thing. Maybe that's the appeal. I don't share the fascination with Trash Can Man that the fans clearly do, but I think that is it. It's just that ultimate outsider in his moment of power.
He's wild and he's untamed and society couldn't control him. He was an agent of chaos even when there were people to sort of keep order in a way, people, you know, to care for him or to constrain him. And to me, he's kind of, I wouldn't say like he's one of my favorite characters. I find him to be really interesting. He's like a big purple poisonous rose on this birthday cake. Like he's like Renfield from Dracula and kind of like, like crossed with Gollum.
That's brilliant, Anthony. That's brilliant.
Yeah, that's really.
He's totally Renfield.
You know, spoiler, we're getting a little bit ahead, but like you think about that Gollum's way more enmeshed in the overall story, but it's ultimately Gollum that leads to the destruction of the ring. And it's Trash Can Man who brings destruction to Vegas. But I think it's also like he's a bit of a free agent, right? Like he's which of these societies that rise up are terraformed for the atmosphere that would attract a Trash Can Man? And he doesn't go toward the society that's trying to build a new world and care for each other and get the electricity back on and create a better society like the one Glenn describes. Like if you get five people together, you'll recreate discrimination and prejudice. Like they're trying to fix the things that went wrong with the previous society. Trash Can Man, he's not going to Denver, you know, like he's going to Vegas because that's the atmosphere that attracts violence and fire and brimstone, and that's where he lives.
He's a Sagittarius world. Like me.
Yeah,
we're drawn to the flame. Listen, I feel like this is so fun to do this once a month. I feel like I could talk to you for just hours and hours and hours, but I don't want to keep you. I want to thank everyone for being on the show today. Mike, Tanana Reeve, Anthony, Kate, my new best friend, Kate.
Best friends.
Call me every 5 minutes. Thank you.
And I love The Haunting of Hill House, I have to say that. So,
oh, thank you.
I'm fangirling here.
I hope we didn't pull back the curtain too much.
Next month, by the way, we'll be discussing chapters 43 through 49, which doesn't sound like much, but it actually is a little more than 200 pages. Go ahead and start your reading of that. You all can get notified. Every listener can get notified of when new episodes go live by subscribing at thestandpodcast.com. Again, that's thestandpodcast.com. You'll also find links to bonus podcast episodes where I drone on and on for hours by myself. To Nana Reeve Dew's online course, you'll find links to that. Anthony's first look at CBS's The Stand for Vanity Fair. You'll find all kinds of things over at thestandpodcast.com. And as we close today's episode, The Stand Podcast asks you to take a stand. There are so many emergency medical technicians and firefighters who are or were first responders of the COVID-19 pandemic, and we want to support those who have battled medical issues because of this, who have debilitating injuries or personal tragedies as a result of being on the front lines. The EMS FDNY Help Fund ensures the welfare of the heroes who did put their lives on the line in the epicenter of this pandemic in New York City. So go to thestandpodcast.com, scroll down, and make a donation today. And until next time, remember the place where you make your stand doesn't matter, only that you do, and that you're still on your feet.